Welcome to God and Country Biblical Exposition. Today's program is part four in the Corona Crisis series. There are still many biblical truths to discuss. I haven't even begun to discuss all of the texts that deal with plagues and pestilence. But the topic for today's program is cleanliness is next to godliness. And that's an old adage found in early America. The earliest recorded instance of that saying comes from 1779 in a sermon by John Wesley. But before we get into that, let me make some overall observations. Listeners have asked me to clarify exactly what I think of the government's reaction to this pandemic. That's the main controversy. That's the issue you're probably talking about with most of your friends. When I'm out walking my dog, strangers tell me from their social distancing, this is absurd what the government is making us do. So on the one side, there are those who are cheerleading the government, even wanting the government to do more. And on the other side, there are those who are criticizing the government's overreach and the panic, claiming that a more moderate, measured approach would be just as effective, maybe even more so. Here's an article from The Federalist, "Why Severe Social Distancing May Result in More Coronavirus Deaths." And the bottom line is that many medical professionals believe that healthy people in the population need to get the virus in order to develop a herd immunity. That's why the 1918 Spanish flu is no longer around. If the spread of the virus is temporarily suspended, it may result in a large future spike in the future. Interesting theory, but who knows? But this we do know. Many states and local police forces are violating common sense and civil liberties. I'm sure you've heard about this lone paddleboarder arrested in California for engaging in unnecessary activity. There he's all by himself out in the middle of the ocean, and yet he's arrested by two police boats. Here's an article about surfers being arrested. Here's an article about people being cited for watching a sunset in their cars. These people are obviously not doing anything that would spread the virus through close human contact. Here's an article in Colorado. Police officers arrest and cuff a man who is playing t-ball with his daughter and his wife in the middle of open acres with no one around. The park sign even says open for exercise. Now, the municipality eventually apologized, but the scary part is that here are four police officers, four grown, supposedly educated men, who interpret the law in an oppressive, draconian, anti-freedom way. How about this story? New Jersey hotline to report businesses breaking coronavirus rules crashed in under an hour. On Tuesday afternoon, Governor Murphy directed New Jerseyans to call a state police hotline if they heard of companies not following his order, whether that be a non-essential retail business that is staying open or an office not setting up work-from-home plans when feasible. It took less than an hour to crash the new hotline as the number was flooded with too many calls. So it's not just the politicians and the police forces. Just like in the old Soviet Union, neighbors couldn't stand other people exercising freedom, so neighbors would turn in neighbors, and the government was more than happy to promote that practice. Here's an article, "New Jersey Town Enforcing Social Distancing with Talking Drones." Quote, "The town of Elizabeth, New Jersey, has unleashed a fleet of talking drones to scold people for hanging out in groups during the coronavirus crisis." According to a report Wednesday, five of the bossy bots on Tuesday began barking orders such as stop gathering while soaring above parks and other public hotspots. These drones will be around the city with an automated message from the mayor telling you to stop gathering, disperse, and go home. The police department announced on Facebook summonses have been and will continue to be issued to those found in violation. Fines are up to $1,000. You have been advised. So where did this mayor get this idea and these drones? From China. These are Chinese-made drones, the drones that the Chinese communists use to tell people what to do. Now, there are many other police officers that have contacted the alternative media saying they are opposed to many of these orders or rulings. Here are some letters from the Matt Walsh Show. I'm a cop in a small town. We get many calls from paranoid people snitching that kids are playing basketball or going fishing. Luckily, we don't enforce any of those BS social distancing rules. I would sooner resign than to take someone to jail for doing something so irrelevant. Or this letter, I'm a police officer in the suburbs of Wisconsin. We have a lot of busybodies calling in stay-at-home violations. If it's a personal residence, we're not even responding to the call. If it's a business, we refer it to the health department. Most of us officers hate how this is turning out and don't feel good about having to enforce any of this. Another officer writes, fortunately, my police department has not told us to enforce violations. And if they do, I will be looking the other way. So there are good officials who understand freedom, who understand constitutional rights, and understand enough about viral contagion to have some good common sense. But then there are others. And this is the ever-present danger of people with high authority and low IQ, where overzealous law enforcement agents take the ruling to mean people should not be doing anything that is unnecessary, when these rulings are clearly to be understood to mean don't be engaged in unnecessary activities that are related to spreading the virus. For example, mowing your lawn is an unnecessary activity, but it doesn't spread the virus. Should police officers stop you from mowing your lawn? Well, some police officers think so. So one thing we can learn from this pandemic is that there is this class of people in every society that are ignorant, vindictive, bitter, control freaks. And these are the people who gravitate toward a state control political mindset. These are the people who always say, well, there ought to be a law. There can be no exceptions. If we let one person do something, we have to let every person do it. They broad brush, they engage in all sorts of logical fallacies, hasty generalization, the slippery slope fallacy. How many people like this have control issues? Like in this Forbes article, 7 signs that you're a control freak and what you can do about it. You know, it's really actually a spiritual problem. It's a moral problem. It's a failure to live by the principles of the Word of God, just like the Pharisees in Jesus' day. You know, I couldn't find a definitive statistic, but I would guess that at least 10% of the population has control issues. And if we don't just limit the number to those who would be clinically diagnosed as having control issues, but include all those who just enjoy having power over other people, we may be talking between 40 to 60% of the population. The problem is when those people fool the masses, come to power, people like Lenin, Stalin, Hitler, these are the people who surround themselves with like-minded, power-hungry people in their administration, and they hire a bunch of brown shirts. We're seeing in this pandemic what statist personality types are capable of doing. Explaining really the psyche of the communists. But that's a whole other subject. If I don't really move on, you know, this YouTube is going to be way too long. The point I'm just trying to make here is that there are two conflicting responses to this virus. Lock down everything, shut down the economy, versus a moderate, limited approach. Here's the point. This conflict is part of the judgment of God. God has put the nation and the politicians between a rock and a hard place, the economy and freedom versus lives. In his Saturday news briefing, President Trump said, "We have a big decision to make at a certain point." Now, he's referring to when to end shelter in place. In the words of the president, "We have told everyone to stay at home and not go to work. That cannot go on indefinitely. We can't make the cure worse than the disease." So what happens in 2 weeks or in 4 weeks when everyone goes back to work? The order will result in at least one person dying who wouldn't have died otherwise, because the virus is still out there. Letting up on the close shutdown orders will mean that the virus will spread. Don't think for a moment that the government is going to completely eliminate this virus simply by isolating people. If we let people go back to work, there is this possibility, and a very likely possibility, of a second wave of infection. Just like what happened in the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918, there was actually two waves. This is what seems to be happening right now in China. So the big decision to make that the president was referring to is how many lives must be sacrificed to allow people to go back to work. People need to work. We cannot continue to live off of the government printing money. But how many lives justify going back to work? So there will be trade-offs. And the president will be criticized for whatever he does if he lets up on the shutdown and just one person goes to work, contracts the virus and dies, his opposition and the media are going to blame him. But the reality is at some point, trade-offs need to be made. We live in a world where we always have to make these trade-offs. Because we're sinners, we live in this fallen world where we have the curse of death upon us. The world will always be a dangerous place. Speaking about the need to work, even though work is dangerous, Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verse 8. "He who digs a pit may fall into it, and a serpent might bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stone may be hurt by them, and he who splits logs may be endangered by them." Yet we still need to do all of these activities. And the reason that the world is such a dangerous place, because in the fall, the environment was changed. Romans chapter 8, "For the creation was subject to futility, to corruption. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers in pains, in the pains of childbirth together until now." So the politicians and the citizenship are between a rock and a hard place, but this has always been the case. After Fauci announced that between 100,000 and 200,000 Americans will die from the coronavirus this year, Lifeline put out this statistic. Worldwide, from January 1st to April 1st of 2020, 3 months, 46,000 people died of the coronavirus, but 120,000 died of seasonal flu, 246,000 died of malaria, 269,000 died of suicide, 338,000 died of traffic fatalities, 421,000 died of HIV/AIDS, 627,000 died of alcoholism, 1.2 million died of smoking-related illnesses, 2 million died of cancer, 2.8 million died of hunger, and 10.6 million died of abortion. So do you get the sense that this world has the wrong priorities? That we've been ignoring many problems? People are just waking up to the fact of death, and they're becoming fearful. I think we can understand why professionals who deal with these greater causes of death look at the government's response to COVID-19 as being an insult. Why the silence on all of these other crises? 50,000 Americans died last year from drug overdose. We used to have a war on drugs, but now few politicians will speak against drugs for fear of being called prudish or being called a racist. The values in this unsaved world are just all messed up. So in regard to this coronavirus, again, the nation is between a rock and a hard place, and this is actually part of the judgment. God is forcing people to face this moral dilemma. And whatever the government does, it will not be able to prevent all deaths. It will not be able to save face. Leaders are saying that they're going to beat this. But they cannot fully beat it. God is going to have his way. And this brings to mind a plague that took place in King David's reign. And the biblical truth is found in that event. 2 Samuel 24 and 1 Chronicles 21. David numbers the people, and this was a sin against the Lord. 1 Chronicles 21:1, then Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. The point is that numbering the people was done out of pride, out of depending on the combined power of man rather than the Lord. 1 Samuel 14:6, the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few. Or Psalm 20, verse 7, some boast in chariots and some in horses, but we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. Or how about Jeremiah 17:5? Thus saith the Lord, curses the man who trusts in mankind and makes flesh his strength and whose heart turns away from the Lord. So in the Mosaic law, whenever a census was to be taken, a special offering had to be given to the Lord. Exodus chapter 30, verse 12, David failed to do this. David numbered the people, and the whole nation was judged because, as the text reads, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel. The king was only a reflection of the sinful attitudes found in the whole population. So no matter how much you might despise politicians, just remember that politicians really just reflect the general population. But here's the interesting part of the text. God gave King David a choice in how the judgment will be met out. 2 Samuel 24:13. So the prophet Gad came to David and told him and said to him, shall 7 years of famine come to you in your land? Or will you flee 3 months before your foes while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days pestilence in your land? Now consider and see what answer I shall return to him who sent me. So David had to choose between judgment by famine, by war, or by disease. 2 Samuel 24:14, then David said to Gad, I'm in great distress. Let us now fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man. So the Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel from the morning until the appointed time, and 70,000 men of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. Now, critics of the Bible look at this as the typical three wishes or the three choice mythology that we find in many stories. You know, the genie comes out of the bottle and grants three wishes. But those mythologies find their origin in biblical truth rather than the other way around. But the lesson here is not simply that David had to choose. The lesson involves what I just referred to. Part of the judgment of God comes with these trade-offs. God puts people between the rock and the hard place. Yes, they could prevent the disease by completely shutting down, but then they would have economic famine. But if they accept an economic famine, foreign enemies will see the weakness, want to take advantage of the weakness, and attack the nation. This was the dilemma Israel was in. Either way, there's going to be trouble. So the deeper lesson here in that text is that there are always these three competing judgments that are related to each other. You can save yourself from one, but you will get it from the other. It's the old adage, you can't win for losing. The judgment is coming. You can try to ameliorate it, but you can't stop it. And that's what's happening in this coronavirus pandemic. It's either more death or economic collapse, The judgment of God is coming because the people of this world need to be humbled. Evil needs to be held in check. And people need a renewed sense of their mortality and their vulnerability. So that's my take on the pandemic. It's the judgment of God that cannot be totally averted. You're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. And it reminds me so much of the moral lesson in Edgar Allan Poe's The Red Death. The elite do everything they can to keep death out, but eventually it finds its way into their party. Well, that's a long introduction. The topic I want to address today is the relationship between physical cleanliness and spiritual cleanliness. And this gets at the heart of why judgment comes upon people in the first place. Sin, whether that be the sin of pride or lust or laziness or greed, sin results in poor behaviors, which results in trouble. And one of those poor behaviors of a sinful disposition is uncleanliness, and uncleanliness results in disease, and disease results in premature death. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 19, your own wickedness will correct you, and your apostasies will reprove you. Often judgment is built right into the sin. And if you rebel against God, you will inevitably do that which will be your undoing. Be sure your sin will find you out. Don't think I will sin against the Lord and disinfect so God cannot get me with a disease. Or I'll use clean needles for my drugs. Or I'll use safe sex practices. Or I will build the best sanitation facilities in Sodom and Gomorrah. We'll show God he can't get us. Sorry, you will fail at some point. You will be in the wrong place at the wrong time doing the wrong thing. Be sure your sin will find you out. But back to the main point. Uncleanliness is one of the consequences or outgrowths of sinful living. And it's one avenue through which God judges our sin. There's no question that the virus spread because of unsanitary conditions in China. These pathogens have been found in what is called the Chinese wet markets. And they're called wet markets because shoppers are buying live animals, having them slaughtered right in front of them, and the blood of these animals is being hosed down constantly. I have here a CNN article from 2015, Why Chinese Food Safety is So Bad. Almost half of Chinese food processing plants fail to meet international acceptable standards. Quality control specialists say 40% of the several thousand inspections, audits, and tests it conducts in China last year failed to meet requirements stipulated by some of its clients, Western food trade companies and retailers. There are horror stories. We find factories that just have no basic ideas about hygiene standards. There was a host of reasons for the failings. In some cases, laboratory tests found abnormal levels of pesticide, antibiotics, heavy metals, bacteria, or viruses that could put consumers at risk. Other transgressions included mislabeling packages, abnormal coloring and odors, bruising, and in the case of seafood, adding water to make fish appear to weigh more than it does. China has experienced a string of stomach-churning food scandals in recent years. Here's a 2014 article from a food safety periodical. China's food safety issues worse than you thought. And here's a testimony of a reporter in China who responded to a petition in America to keep Chinese chicken out of our schools and supermarkets. While this reporter loves China and its people, her firsthand knowledge of China's poor food safety practices leave her deeply concerned about the prospect of American chicken being processed in China for consumption in the United States. China's weak food safety system poses a real threat to America. Food safety has always been an issue in China due to a lack of knowledge about contamination and hygiene standards. Even in Beijing, I can count on contracting food poisoning at least once a year, despite all of my precautions. The problem is, buying anything here that is processed becomes a roll of the dice. Most Chinese believe the food safety system is thoroughly corrupt. Although there are protests, in general, people say nothing can be done. I do know that almost everyone here believes that government officials have their own private farms to assure that their personal food supply is safe. People also widely believe that the government lies about its results in food testing in order to avoid panic and protest. And everybody knows, and everybody knew at the time, that the plagues in Europe, the Black Plague, the Bubonic Plague, the Hong Kong Plague, were all caused by poor sanitation practices. When a plague hit Wittenberg, Germany in the 16th century, Martin Luther wrote in a letter, quote, "Our plague here in Wittenberg has been caused by nothing but filth. The air, thank God, is still clean and pure, but some few have been contaminated because of the laziness and the recklessness of some. So the devil enjoys himself at the terror and the flight which he causes among us. May God thwart him. Amen." Exodus 15:25. "And there God made for them a statute and a regulation, and there he tested them. And he said, if you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all of his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put upon the Egyptians. I am the Lord, I am your healer." The deliverance from disease was linked to obeying the statutes and the regulations of the Lord, both in regard to moral and physical cleanliness. There's a relationship between moral cleanliness and physical cleanliness. You show me a filthy society on the outside, and I will show you a filthy society on the inside. And so in many places in the Mosaic Law, we read about these hygiene requirements, such as Leviticus chapter 5, or if a person touches any unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean beast, or the carcass of an unclean cattle, or the carcass of an unclean swarming thing, though it is hidden from him and he is unclean, then he will be guilty. Or if he touches human uncleanliness, or whatever sorts of uncleanliness may be with which he becomes unclean and it is hidden from him, then he comes to know it, he will be guilty. You know, most people, when they read the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, don't appreciate the importance of the spiritual effect of these sanitation laws. It really did develop a psyche in the people and an understanding of the distinction between the clean and the unclean in the moral realm. That was really the point of these laws. Notice Leviticus chapter 10, verse 10. "And so to make a distinction between the holy and the profane, between the unclean and the clean," the prophet Ezekiel also points out the importance of these laws regarding physical things, teaching the importance of moral distinctions. Ezekiel 22:26, "Her priests have done violence to my law, and they have profaned my holy things. They have made no distinction between the holy and the profane. They have not taught the difference between the unclean and the clean, and they have hidden their eyes from my Sabbaths, and I am profaned among them." C.S. Lewis, in his novel Pilgrim Regress, he has the main character come into the realization that the sinful spirit of the age was not making and was unable to make distinctions between clean and unclean. Quote, "You're trying to pretend that unlike things are alike. You're trying to make us think that milk is the same sort of thing as sweat or dung. You see no difference between what nature casts out as refuse and that which she stores up as food." And that describes the current era of moral relativism and LGBTQ. So, in the Bible, physical uncleanliness is related to and becomes an illustration of moral uncleanliness. One of the sanitary regulations is found in Deuteronomy 23, where God commands the people to clean up their excrement in the camp, Deuteronomy 23:12. You shall also have a place outside the camp and go out there. And you shall have a spade among your tools, and it shall be when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and shall turn to cover up your excrement. Verse 14, since the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to defeat your enemies before you, therefore your camp must be holy, and he must not see anything indecent among you, or he will turn away from you. So when you do your business, bury it, lest someone steps in it, and the Lord walks among you, and he doesn't want to step in it either. Now, obviously, this is an anthropomorphic expression where attributes of man are attributed to God just for the purpose of teaching. I mean, God doesn't physically walk in the camp, but notice there the connection between moral holiness and the need for physical cleanliness. Your camp must be holy, and it's reflected in your sewer system. In Exodus chapter 19, verse 14, in the day that the Lord descended on Mount Sinai, the Lord told Moses, tell the people to wash their clothing. Physical uncleanliness, dirt, was a way to illustrate the unseen spiritual reality of sin. And when the soul of man is unclean, it will be reflected in an unclean lifestyle. That's why Christian cultures tend to be clean and orderly, while pagan cultures tend to be filthy. When I attended Rutgers University, a secular, godless place, the first thing I noticed was the filth on campus. I did 6 years at a Christian university, and there everything was spotless. There was not a weed in the lawn, and you could eat off the floor. But by comparison, Rutgers was a dump. And Rutgers had a huge budget. They probably had a budget that's thousands of times larger than the small Christian college, but they just couldn't keep the place clean. It just wasn't in their heart to do it. So you ever notice the difference between ungodly neighborhoods, neighborhoods with bars and drugs, versus godly neighborhoods? In ungodly neighborhoods, people throw out the trash onto the ground. There's graffiti. The paint is peeling. The great error made by sociologists is to blame the filth on poverty. Because of their wrong worldview, they invert the cause and the effect. They assume poverty causes drugs and laziness and indifference when it's actually the other way around. It's a moral problem. It's not an economic problem. The morals of people are seen in their outward behavior. The art reflects the heart. Proverbs chapter 24. I passed by the field of a sluggard and by the vineyard of a man lacking sense. And behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. So it's not about how much money you have. As I heard many times growing up, we may be poor, but we don't have to be dirty. How about Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 8? Let your clothing be white at all times, and let not oil be lacking on your head. Perfume, cologne. Now, the point being made in Ecclesiastes is that even though there is vanity of vanity, everything is vanity, someday everything is going to go up in flames, we still ought to keep everything around us clean and neat. Why? Well, because we're sons and daughters of the King of Heaven. We're to reflect the glory of God and His holiness in our dress, in our environment, in our behavior. And our physical environment reflects the condition of our soul. To put it bluntly, if you're a slob on the outside, you're likely a slob on the inside. Jordan Peterson, that popular libertarian psychologist, professor in Toronto, has a lecture called Clean Your Room. And although Peterson is not what we would call an evangelical Christian, he has a good understanding of natural law, the law of God revealed in nature. And he says the following about hoarders. You go into their house and there's a box filled with old bills, with old coins, with papers and a dead mouse. There are boxes piled up upon boxes. There's absolute chaos there. And you ask, is that their house or is that their being? And the answer is, there's no difference. If you want to organize your psyche, you can start by organizing your room. If that would be easier, if you're a concrete person and you need something concrete to do. What are you organizing? Are you organizing the objective world or are you organizing your field of being? Like your field of total experience. There is no difference between you and what you experience. Treat it as an extension of yourself. So this really sheds a lot of light on why the law of God puts such an emphasis on physical cleanliness. It wasn't just about how well physical stuff needs to be organized around us. It was really a reflection of the soul. If there's chaos and sin in your soul, there will also be in your environment. Disease, filth, disorganization is a heart problem. And the physical is there to represent the spiritual, and it's there to help us to see the spiritual problem. And the New Testament directs us to glean these spiritual truths from these Old Testament physical regulations. For example, Hebrews chapter 9, verse 9. The regulations concerning food and drink and washings were symbols. In other words, they had a deeper meaning, which is to be understood. And this is why Paul quotes the Old Testament concerning feeding the oxen that are working for you. 1 Corinthians 9, 9. And then Paul writes, does God care about the oxen? And the implied answer is not so much. The real point was about the justice of compensation. And notice 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 17. Therefore, come out from their midst and be separate, saith the Lord, and do not touch what is unclean, and I will welcome you. In that 2 Corinthians text, Paul is telling believers not to be morally aligned or to compromise with unbelievers. And Paul quotes Old Testament hygiene standards. Leviticus 5, do not touch anything that's unclean. Paul is drawing the spiritual lesson from these sanitation laws. Isaiah 52, 11, depart, depart, go out from there, touch nothing unclean, go out from the midst of her, purify yourselves, you who carry the vessels of the Lord. So, in short, here's my take on the coronavirus. The great pandemic in this world is the pandemic of sin. And the coronavirus disease is just a reflection or an illustration of that greater disease, sin. And the washing or the disinfecting we need is not so much physical, but spiritual. We need to be washed on the inside more than the outside, and only God can do that. Ezekiel 36:25, then I will sprinkle clean water on you and you will be clean. I will cleanse you from all of your filthiness and from all of your idols. And that washing, that sprinkling of water, is the regeneration of the soul by the Holy Spirit. Remember Titus chapter 3, verse 5. He saved us not on the basis of deeds which we have done in righteousness, but according to his mercy, by the washing of regeneration and the renewing by the Holy Spirit. There is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins, and sinners plunged beneath that flood lose all their guilty stains. Thank you for making God and country a part of your discipleship in the Word. Subscribe, like, leave a comment below, and may Jesus Christ reign.